New tidings of good news. August printing shipments were up. The data came out just yesterday. And on a current dollar basis, they've been up for the last 5 months. And on an inflation-adjusted basis, they've been up for the last 4 out of 5 months. And this is quite a welcome bit of news. And it establishes some questions for us. Is this election-related? Well, I went back to look at the history. And in the past 3 or 4 midterm elections, the value of print on both the current dollar and inflation-adjusted basis have been basically going down. But is this related to the change in sentiment and a lot of the independent voters needing to reach out? I mean, they've been connecting to each other via Facebook and other online things, but when they need to reach out to the rest of the electorate, perhaps they are using print. We're not going to know this for months after. But this is a possible explanation for it. The other thing is that we've bottomed out a little bit here, and that that print has found a different level of shipments in the economy and in communications for some time. Again, we're not going to know that for quite a while. So that scenario is equally plausible to me, because we've had that kind of period before, and in recent history, it's lasted about 2.5 years. That was generally around 2005, 2006. In each case, the total volume of printing shipments actually went down, but at least they were more consistent with the prior year. If things continue at the rate they have for the last 5 months, the industry will finish about $1 billion to $1.5 billion higher than it was last year, which would be very good news. We haven't had that for quite a while. But let's see what happens. If we get a big drop-off in November shipments, which we won't know until February, then what good does it do us now, at that time, right? We won't know that until February, but we'll have a sense of possibly what happened to employment in the industry. And I'll talk about employment as we go on a little bit. But let's talk about the economy. I thought I would give a brief update of what's been happening. We had our webinar about 2 weeks ago, and there have been some changes since then. Today we're waiting for the last part of our recovery indicators, and at some point this morning Debbie will rush in and give me the numbers while we're taking our little break. And we'll fill this in, but our recovery indicators have slowed down quite considerably. They're still better than they were, for the most part, from the Institute of Supply Management. There was some concern in this most recent report, just from last Friday, that the prices of materials are starting to shoot up, and that's not good. That's related to the continuing devaluation of the dollar, which doesn't seem to have much of an end in sight, the way certain monetary policies are being implemented. So that could be a serious problem. People forget that when you're looking at trade deficits, which don't really matter all that much, but in that whole concept of analyzing these things and the way they affect the value of the dollar, is that more than half of all of the trade is intercompany transfers in multinational corporations. So those companies have their dollar situation kind of straightened out, because they have a transaction on both ends of the deal. It's everything else that's in play. And the other thing the weak dollar does, it makes raw materials higher in price, and eventually that starts to filter through the rest of the economy inflation sometime later on. And it does depress investment and the like, but it takes a while to play out. And so we'll be watching this quite carefully. But the inflation component of the ISM manufacturing report took a good jump up. We got an update of GDP for the second quarter, and it went from 1.6 to 1.7. That's the annualized rate all the way over there in the corner. I like to look at things on a year-over-year basis. So second quarter to second quarter, it was up 3%, and that rate has been declining. We get an employment report this Friday, and I'm not expecting it to be particularly good in the long term, because productivity is still exceeding GDP. And this is a continuing theme in the economy where efficiency is trumping out over expansion. And that's our problem. In most recoveries, you get both together. But as long as you have productivity going up at a faster rate than GDP, there's no need on an aggregate basis to continue to hire workers. You'd much rather expand their hours or give them new equipment. And that's a theme, I believe, that's very important for the printing industry, and we'll get toward that later. Earnings have finally started to catch up with productivity a little bit, but for quite a long time, and this may be the case as new benefits and new regulations go through the employment system, where real earnings of workers, especially disposable income, which is after taxes, get depressed, and people have difficulty affording products, even though inflation is low. If your incomes are going down, basically you've made everything cost more because their incomes are down. So the inflation indicators may look like they're tame, but you have to look at it in comparison with the earnings. So CPI, that's the consumer prices, the prices of things that you buy on the shelf at the store, those look relatively tame, but the producer prices are going up. So there's a lot of inflation backed up in the system. So even though the last report of the PPI showed a decrease in prices, that's going to probably rapidly turn around. So this theme of efficiency and expansion is playing out through the economy. And we see this because investment in things like computer and communications technology in some quarters has been up as much as 20 to 25%. And there's good reason for that. We now have technologies that allow us to communicate all kinds of things from video images, which are very, very large files, but now going over very fast networks and with other technologies that allow compression and the like, you can have a lot greater delivery of not just entertainment, but the business information and other mission-critical stuff going through that particular pipeline. But in a traditional recovery, you see both. You see companies becoming more efficient because they're not just buying infrastructure like computers, they're buying everything. So the productivity would go up, but you're also seeing them look to expand because the economy is expanding at a rate greater than their productivity. And we haven't had that for quite a long period. And I don't see that happening for a while either. Now, there is a common saying that when people look at the productivity numbers that, this can't go on forever. In actuality, that's how a country or a nation raises its income, because it does go on forever. And a good example of this is the tuck-in in a commercial printing plant. Basically, one company dies, the volume shifts over to another place. Some of the employees are kept, others exit. But that volume is there, that makes that particular company more productive, so their productivity goes up. So if you look at it that way, we've got another 27,000 consolidations to go until we have one printing company and be the most productive industry on the planet. But that's obviously not going to happen. But the productivity changes because new markets are created, new products are created, new industries develop. If you look at what Google has done, what are they, $23 billion company? It's almost like Seinfeld. It's like the company about nothing. It's all these little text ads, which are like 90-something percent of their income. So this can keep going. So if anybody tells you, productivity can't get much better, yes, because you can have a replacement of something else from a totally different industry that you're not expecting. In our last survey, which was done at the end of June, beginning of July, we found a general across the board increase in printing activity. This is the percentage at the bottom of companies that said their business was up 6% or more. How is this happening? I'll tell you. We had the exit of a lot of very unprofitable, marginally successful printing businesses. We probably lost somewhere between 2,500 and 3,500 companies in about a two-year period before this one. So the industry's been cleaning itself out. Also, when you get this wave of consolidations in it, that also helps tremendously. So now you have companies both from a combination of organic growth, the people who really understand what's going on are able to adapt, and also volume that comes from other companies you see that conspiring together to produce these kinds of businesses. So this leads us to the issue of survivor bias. This means that the aggregate industry shipments can actually go down, but the individual companies can be doing better. So I believe that we are in a period like that right now, and I'll explain why I believe that very shortly. One of the reasons is that the printing profits went up, and this chart, the reddish line, are consumer price index adjusted printing shipments, and the blue line, which is and also is on the right axis, is inflation adjusted annualized industry profits. Now the profits are nothing to write home about, but the direction is the way we want it to be. And even though printing shipments were declining, there was finally some profitability in the industry. And that's occurring partly because of the consolidations, but also because of another factor. Right now, shipments of our industry are going up, on a current dollar and an inflation-adjusted basis, but the number of our employees is going down. And this is not to say that companies will do better if they get rid of all their employees. It's unfortunately that we have the best data we have, the best window we have in what's going on in printing plants is employment data because it's published every month. We can't see all the other things that are going on in there, the other accommodations that they're making in their business. But this is a sign that that there is quite a change here, that companies are becoming more efficient, at least in terms of the labor. We believe they're becoming more efficient in lots of other ways, too, especially the consolidation, the ripping out of unproductive equipment, the elimination of unproductive firms is going on all the time. And so that reddish line, that's the percentage change on a quarterly basis. We averaged it out of the decline in printing employees, and you see that's down about 8% as of this last reading that we did, and shipments were down about 0.5% or so, you know, using that. There was a period where we had some really tough times last year, and that gap that you see with that red hour is that's the delay factor that the industry had between the time it was kind of right-sizing itself through the time it was actually getting its shipments and its employee base in line. And that's why, if we go back to this other slide, that's why you still see the shipments going down, but the profits going up. My sense is that this is going to be a theme for the next year or so. And this is the other piece of the puzzle that I think confirms that, and that is that the hiring that we have, and I know it's hard to see this chart, but those numbers that are in bold on the top line, that line is no plans to hire. Now, the idea that a 1-to-4 employee shop, generally a shop doing less than $500,000, isn't going to hire anybody should not be a surprise. But when you get into some of the other sectors, like the 10-to-19, 30% with no plans to hire, and then on the third line is only to fill openings that occur. That is really the middle part of our market. So that's somewhere between 35% and 40% or so of companies saying that in about the million dollar in sales all the way up. And then the larger size, which I have here, is 50 or more employees. That tends to be about a $6 million business. Need additional personnel to support growth in our business. One quarter of them said that. Isn't that nice? So one of our more hopeful signs there. This is a really critical issue to bring up, what I call the real story about prices. And, of course, I'm here, so we're talking about real and inflation, so that's what that means. So I thought we would look at what happened to our industry from 1990 to 2000, and then 2000 to 2010, and then let's kind of speculate what that means for the future. And I believe that this is an explanation of why we have to look outside of our industry in a grander context to see how print fits in and how all the other technologies relate to us. So let's just do the middle column. So from 2000 to 2010, the consumer price index was up 25%, but the producer price index for commercial printing was up 9%. So we lagged inflation by 16 percentage points. And many people will explain this as, well, sure, that's overcapacity, and they'll go through all that stuff. And I assume that most people's eyes glaze over when I talk about that particular topic. But it's not a useful topic to anyone, because it doesn't take into issues of product mix, market prices, and things like that. And so this is basically the effect of new media on our business, and the fact that there are other alternatives to do a lot of the things that print did. And this has been going on for quite some time, and you see that the gap in 1990 to 2000 was 10% difference, and then it became a 16% difference. And now, what is it going to be for these next 10 years? A 20% difference, a 25% difference, as we try to cope and get our piece of all these other communications budgets. It's not a surprise that the printing equipment would tend to follow these kinds of things. So I could, the 2000 to 2010 is a little bit closer in that, because consistently printers have spent somewhere on an industry average, somewhere between 4.5% to 5% of their sales on capital investment. So the prices would tend to follow that, and any kind of deviation there might be some other kind of competitive factors. But here's the real point of this. I bet you were wondering when I was going to get to that. Computer equipment was down 75% in both decades. That's where we play every day. We don't always realize it, but those iPads and those smartphones and all that, that's where we play every day in the way people get communication and the way people want to communicate with others. Those keep going down. An iPad today would probably be, with its current features, would probably be about $75 or $50 in 2020. And so as you see, the continuing declining cost of communications and that equipment will be our biggest competitor going forward. And cellular connectivity will just keep going down. I mean, it will end up being virtually free. And if you have Wi-Fi and nowhere to go, it's free all the time. So we've definitely been seeing that. So this is why I always implore people, whether you are a vendor, whether you are a printer, to inflation adjust your prices. And one of the questions I always get, and I'll preempt it here, well, if printing prices are staying basically the same, why should I inflation adjust? Because when you pay your employees and when you go home at the end of the day, they don't put commercial printing money in your pocket. You have to spend that money out in a marketplace. So the job of any kind of firm is to supply income to its owner and also income to all the people who help the owner. And if those dollars are worth less in the marketplace, then lots of problems occur. So we need to get ahead of the curve quite a bit. If we know commercial printing prices are not going to be keeping up with the marketplace, then we have to make accommodations elsewhere in our business. And that relates to the productivity of our business, relates to the products that we sell, the margins of those products, what kind of product mix we have among all of them, relates to the training and knowledge of all of our people in the shops. So this should give a sense of urgency about things, and that will be part of the theme as we get a little deeper in here. So I publish these on about every 6 months in my column. But the way this works is this. Let's say you're a $1 million company in 2010. I'll use really round numbers. In 2010, and you did $1 million in sales in 2005. That $1 million in 2005 was worth more in today's dollars. That $1 million was worth $1.1 million. Okay, so that's the way you use these. Just take these weights, put them in Excel for your income statements or whatever, and then you'll start to see different trends in your business. And then whoever got the tall glass for the pessimist mug will find that putting other things in it that are not necessarily approved at work might be helpful in coping with the numbers, at least for that evening. So how do we make many of these transitions? And this is a marvelous image that Richard Romano put in, if he's still paying attention, put into disrupting the future, that the status quo is nothing. There's no such thing. I wish that the person who came up with the phrase business as usual, I guess You might have been speaking to a journalist or somebody, because it got picked up by everyone decades and centuries ago. There's no such thing. When you have the computer equipment folks going down 75% per decade and the connectivity folks going down 30% per decade, there's no such thing as business as usual when you have content that could be sent all around the world. It reminds me of my discussion once with somebody from the post office where they said, don't you know that you can put a stamp for 44 cents on an envelope and it can be in Hawaii in 3 days? Don't you know how amazing that is? And I said, yes, that's very amazing. Let me download Skype and I'll call somebody in Hawaii and we'll see each other on our computers and I'll tell them I mailed them a letter. It doesn't work this way anymore. That's the kind of situation that we're in. So the status quo should be changed on a regular basis. That's part of the theme of the book, and if you get the book, you'll see why that is. I was trying to get a feel for how do we plan change, and I got this crazy idea. I wanted to find out how many days there are until January 1st, 2020. Of course, there's a website for this. And I found out that as of today, there will be 3,375 days. And I just said it was 10 years. It's not 10 years, actually. But I said, okay, the two weekend days a year, unless somebody changes the calendar. So you got the 1,040 weekend days and 130 holidays, because it's generally about 13 holidays a year. But I couldn't figure out Excel enough to make this work, be multiplied against 9 instead of 10, excuse me. So we have dead days of 2,205. Gosh, wouldn't it have been neat had I been able to make it come out so we'd have 2,020 days to reach 2020. Wouldn't that be neat? But I don't manipulate my data. But next year I might be able to do that. And the idea is that every day is important when you're trying to make a transition, when you're in a very, very dynamic marketplace. We don't always see the dynamism from behind our desks. But when you think about the fact that for 18 years or so, we've lost 1,000 printing companies every year, and it intensified for a little while recently, that's 3 printing companies a day go out of business. Right? So it's pretty urgent for them. And that's the way we have to look at it in our business, because all these technologies and all these social changes, nobody's keeping a timetable on them. They are working, and our job is to navigate them, which is a reminder about the purpose of what forecasting is. Don't believe any forecasts. As somebody who does forecasts and writes about forecasts regularly, I'll tell you, don't believe any forecasts, because you always have people in the marketplace coming up with things that you're never, ever going to know about. You can't know anything about the future for certain, but you can, in terms of a quantitative thing, but you can know that there are general trends working in the environment. But most of all, that forecasts are springboards to doing something in your business, because they help you analyze the assumptions that you have about your business. And if the problem is that not enough of us really step back and look at what that means. And play this out. We know that printing prices are not going to keep up with the decline in computerization. So what do we have? What do we do for that? Well, one of the things is we adopt computerization in our business on a regular basis to continually make us more productive. But then we have to come up with ways to cope in the marketplace with products that we offer in that. And this is where we get into that whole issue of, do printers get involved in social media? Do they get involved in location-based marketing and things like that? I mean, years ago, location-based marketing used to mean that you printed travel brochures, right? And today, it means that you have Foursquare on your iPhone. Aggregate industry data are just that. They're aggregate. They are totals. And you never see the dynamism that's inside a marketplace. For 20 or so years ago, we've had 3,000 printing businesses go out every year and 2,000 printing businesses come in every year. It's the same people, basically. They're changing their business structure very often. So you may have two small businesses in the town, especially now, decide to close their business and open a new business together. This is kind of a poor man's consolidation, because sometimes in these M&A things, the only people who make money are the lawyers, right? So this is the way a lot of companies will deal with that, because they may have family matters tied up in a business and the like. So that's a lot of what happens in there. But if you look at the industry totals, all you see is, oh, we're going down 1,000 companies a year. So keep an eye on that. The other thing is that the industry profits are likely to keep going up, even though demand is going down and the number of establishments are going down. So we could have a slowly declining industry in terms of its volume and the number of businesses doing it, but the bottom lines could be improving because the weight of the economy and the weight of all those declining prices of electronic communications keep making the companies more effective in the marketplace and also more productive when they start using them. And I feel that there's not enough emphasis in any kind of economic analysis about our industry that really specifies on the importance of the individual firm and the importance of the entrepreneurship of that firm, and more importantly, getting more and more. You know, we're always looking for new employees. I don't want new employees. I want new entrepreneurs. They'll hire new employees. That's what we need. We need that spark in the industry, because that's how the hiring actually becomes. Now, to give this a further greater context, I'd like to do this little exercise of giving you these three particular numbers to keep in mind that I'll start going through. This is not my measurements before I started my low-carb diet, okay? But 30, 60, and 100. All these are going to play out over these next 10 years. Computers will be 30 times faster in 2020 than they are today if you follow Moore's Law. They have a lot of technological barriers in order to do that, but somehow they always find a way to do it. So what can you do with computers that are 30 times faster than they are today? Well, the first thing is the computers that are not 30 times faster become incredibly cheap. And they'll just be all over the place. They'll even be inside people. We'll be implanting chips in people, I'm sure, with medical records for somebody who might be ill, may have a certain disease that an EMT may want to know about. Maybe we do something like that. But there's all kinds of wild things that are going to be occurring with this. Most of the time, over this next decade, this extra computing power is going to be spent on making displays faster and putting more data through the pipeline, especially in terms of video and animation. So we may not see it in the way that we use Excel or word processing and all that, and those things are kind of fast already, but we're going to see it in other kinds of media as they play through. And as you have people connected all the time with having faster computers, I mean, if you think about how fast an iPhone is compared to the original PCs, I mean, the iPhone might as well be a supercomputer. It's tremendous opportunities. 60 million people have been born since Netscape went public in 1995. That means they have not lived a single day without the internet being in public use. So they have no clue what it's like to do something before we started to use the internet. And it's kind of striking when you consider that another 50 million of them are going to be born in the next 10 years. And older people who tend not to use digital media as often, about 30 million of them are going to exit the marketplace, if you know what I mean. So that means by 2020 you have 110 million, or a little over one-third of the U.S. populace, living in a time when they know no pre-internet time. So you're going to see the usage rates of digital media just keep going up in the older age groups, because younger people have a habit of getting old. Thank goodness. And 100 is the goal of the FCC to have 100 megabits broadband in every household in the U.S. by 2020. This is about a 6 to 7 time increase over what it is today on U.S. average. For those of you who are attached to good cable internet networks, it's probably about a 3 times rate. So if you've noticed that over the past few years, as you've had higher speed internet, you leave your computer on all the time and you start doing more things with video and all that, and whether it's phone calling or watching something strange on YouTube, usually involving cats, Although they have lolcats for that, don't they? Yeah. Okay. But I think you get the point. And this is like a regulation. So they're already putting their money behind this. They're not putting their money behind us. They're putting their money behind this. So this is going to be a very, very big issue. Now, how does this play out for somebody like the Postal Service? I have no idea what's going on there, but I suspect in the back of somebody's mind is that they're going to eliminate the clause for the Postal Service that says they must supply universal service, and they're going to replace it with everybody has universal service with data coming into wherever they live. Because in many rural areas, it's cheaper to give folks who live in those outer areas computers and a free connection than it is to give them postal service. Because we know computer equipment's going down 75% every 10 years and connectivity's going down. So I don't know if that's in the back of anybody's head, but that's one of the things that I start to think of, the way that the organization is going. There was a greater relationship to the change in printing shipments with the amount of time people spend online in broadband. It's a stronger statistical relationship than there is with the economy. Now, does that change over time? I don't know, but I haven't seen new data that I could use to plug into this, to run this again, to see what's happened lately. But that relationship, because people can get more data and be online more often, this also affects cable companies and cable networks in an interesting way. Cities like New York City has already changed their relationship with Time Warner Cable, so that if more and more people start watching Hulu and other sites to get access to their cable channels and TV shows, that means that tax revenues from taxing cable bills are going to start going down, because instead of getting cable and internet service, people are just going to get internet service, and I'll watch whatever shows are on Hulu or whatever, I'll even subscribe to them. So they're already concerned about this. I mean, the governments are always concerned about what's going to happen to taxes, and they're already seeing this playing out. So cable companies may actually become what we call today destination websites. And you won't see cable channels anymore, or people will just start dropping their cable service and picking and choosing. So then it becomes a real communications challenge. How do we get people to know that our channel is available and these are the programs? And strangely enough, print may be a very good vehicle to do that on a regular basis. This is how badly the magazine thing played out over this last decade. And I find this really funny, because the Magazine Association has loads of stuff on their site about how strong magazines are, how people read magazines, how people love magazines. Then why have they stopped buying them? Nobody's answered that question. But let me just walk through this with you a little bit in case you haven't seen this before. Our population grows almost about 1% per year. That's at the top line. So everything is scaled for 100. So everything here, you can see the percentage change. Since 2000, magazine subscription circulation is down about 3%. Remember what we've lost. We've lost a lot of news weeklies. We've lost TV Guide. Reader's Digest is nowhere near what it was. Lots of the of magazines are that way. In fact, magazine subscriptions for newsstand and for, magazine circulation for newsstand and circulation together is flat for about 25 years. But in that time, because of desktop publishing and other technologies, we've had an explosion in smaller niche titles. Not many of them have very long lives, because as soon as the trendiness of the topic disappears, the magazine disappears. But it's far easier to create a magazine today than any other time. So that's one, with the loss of all the news weeklies and all those other publications, that's why that has stayed flat. The yellow line is the post office's calculation of the weight of the periodicals mailed. And that is down, that's the yellow line, that's down about 35%, because that's between the 70 and the 60. The blue line is the number of periodicals mailed, and that's down about 78%. So the gap is the magazines are thinner, that there's fewer ad pages. How do we know that there are fewer ad pages? Because the bottom purple line is an index that we created from the Publishers Information Bureau data for consumer magazines, and that shows that ad pages are down about, what is that? 45%, thank you. I'm glad somebody in here knows statistics. Gosh. So this is how this has played out. Yet you'll hear pronouncements about how great magazines are and all this, but make the case. Make the case that that people are using them in that particular way. And this is a survivor bias issue. You study the people who are still using them, and then you end up ignoring everybody on the outside. Does this mean magazines are dead? No, it doesn't mean magazines are dead. It means magazines are different. And many of them are finally realizing that they're not just a magazine, they're a brand. And branded communications, and companies like ESPN are perfect examples of that, where they're in any kind of media virtually and appearing on any kind of device. And that kind of pattern is what is going to play out for all communications. This was a very interesting story. If any of you read Seth Godin, you know, he's kind of the trendy marketing guy and always fun to read, fun to listen to, and the like. He got tired of his publisher. Not that he didn't like getting money from his publisher. Publishers, you know, and he have done a good job. He got tired of the publishing production cycle. So he has enough of a stature that he's going into self-publishing and managing his own content. His publisher's going to be publishing one last book. It takes almost a year for something Seth Godin writes to appear in print and go through the editorial and production process. Well, with some of the stuff that he's doing, and one of the things that he emphasizes is how quick businesses have to turn around and how people follow his blog and all that, and how people have to react to marketplaces quickly, this doesn't fit with him at all. I could see why it would be very frustrating. It also means that he'll be selling in multiple formats. He'll be actively pushing ebooks because for his audience, ebooks is a very good format for him. But also means he'll be self-publishing. One thing that will play out over this next decade is the stigma of self-publishing is going to start disappearing, because many large authors are going to take control of their content, hire their own staffs, and distribute their content in ways that they see fit. So the traditional publishing industry, this is another thing that the rug gets pulled out from under them. Instead of being a filter to the marketplace, when the author then becomes responsible fully for their content in the marketplace. How this affects marketing, I don't know, because one of the jobs of the publisher was to help market the books and bring the authors to prominence. And with some authors, they have been able to find that the combination of social media and buzz and YouTube videos and all that, they've been able to do that themselves. So there's going to be a cottage industry, and I would recommend many printers really take a good hard look at this, because self-publishing doesn't always mean digital, that the printers will be able to offer many of these services to promote, give authors who don't have the pipeline, who don't have the time or don't have the staff, to promote their books as well, far beyond what Lulu and some others do for their authors, I mean, but really actually do it with the video production and the like. So I'll be watching this very, very carefully over these next years. And you folks should too. This is a story in the New York Times about 2 weeks ago of a restaurant in Atlanta called Bones. It's a steakhouse, which bought 30 iPads and are using it for their wine list. Now, the first thing I thought of is, how do you stop the customers from walking out of the restaurant with the iPad? But they found that their sales of wine, and they have, I think it was over 2,000 different vintages in their wine cellar, so it's a very, very extensive collection. Their sales of wine went up because people could go on the iPad, explore, and get far more detailed information about the wine. And this is also tied into the inventory system, so their customers are not presented with things that are not there in the wine cellar. So, again, the iPad is $500 right now. They bought 30 of them. We know that they could have gotten wine lists printed a lot cheaper than $15,000. What's the compelling proposition here? That they achieve a lot of other productivity in their business, and they're also able to present things in a way to their customers that allows them to get more information about the products they want and feel more certain about their purchase. So the more information they have in this process, they are more willing to spend extra. So there was probably a desire all along for them to try out a more expensive wine, but be a little reluctant to do it because either the waiter or the wine steward didn't know enough about it, or they had to do their research before they went to the restaurant. So they might have seen something on the menu and then researched it later at home. Now they can do it right on site. And this restaurateur has other restaurants, and they're introducing this in there too. And other restaurants are watching this as well. This I just found two days ago, how Facebook can become bigger than Google is today. Google's about $23 billion in sales. Anybody want to guess how much in sales? Now, Facebook's not public, but about how much in sales Facebook has?
Five.
Good guess. It's wrong, but it's an excellent guess. Did they say that in the movie? The movie's hot now. It's $2 million. Right? $2 billion, excuse me. $2 billion, that's a lot of money. And what are they doing? They're just presenting little ads and having little... people are viewing things here and there, but people are on Facebook so often. Facebook time surpassed email time 3 years ago. How many of you are on Facebook? How many of you are... Keep your hands up. How many of you are on Facebook only to watch the kids? it's an incredible platform, and they're going to be making a deal with Skype, so people will be making phone calls over Facebook and having conference calls over that network as well. That was just announced the other day. Groupon is a very successful startup. They'll probably be getting funded very, very soon to lots of news coverage. But what they do is have a deal a day for a restaurant or for some other retailer that you subscribe to over email. Like most coupon programs for restaurants, they don't always work, but some restaurants are reporting incredible changes, especially for times when their restaurants are not busy. So like Monday nights or Tuesday nights, and getting people into their facilities. So Facebook, if they provide all these particular services, can easily, according to this author, pass Google. I presented this particular slide. I presented something like this last year. But if you want to download this yourself, we're going to have the PDF of the presentation available later. But if you want to download this yourself, or now, tinyurl.com/mediachart. And you can see all the different things that print businesses and others can get involved in. The media business, even for small and mid-sized businesses, has become more complex and more bewildering. And this is one of the grander opportunities, I believe, that the printing organizations can have. We are at a time when we've been doing lots of things like trade shows, where we didn't know that trade shows were social media. But they are. They are the first social media, if you want to put it that way. Or maybe religious services were the first social media. But any gathering like that was always social media. It's just that it didn't become media. It was just social until it started to be done online or be supported by digital technology. But back when I went to school, we only had offline and push and pull. Push was more traditional sales, and pull was the use of marketing. But this category of collaborative is only some very recently, and online is only 15 years old. So we have four new cells in this chart. And this is an opportunity for printers to sit down with their clients, especially their small and mid-sized clients, and help them exploit these many different kinds of things. And some of them, the offline one, is loaded with stuff that has inks or some kind of chemical on a substrate. But the point of all this is that each one of these has a particular application or a strategy to it. And by working with our clients and making a transition to those, we're also changing our businesses to have more and more of those services. So a lot of the secrets of the success of diversified services for printing businesses are in here. Now, we're going to be revising this at some point. We can't decide, or at least I can't decide. I think Richard Romano has decided that there is a column for mobile, but I don't know if mobile is just a different class of online yet. I'm kind of leaning in that direction, but a lot of the location stuff kind of makes me think, oh, gee, maybe this is like Four. Any of you use Foursquare? You do? Are you the mayor of Graph Expo yet? The rest of the people don't know what that means. If you visit a place often enough, the Foursquare software declares you as the mayor of that location. I don't know what it gets you, the adulation of millions of other Foursquare users. But if any of you don't know what location-based marketing is, if someone on Foursquare is outside your restaurant, you can send them some kind of promotion to get them to walk in.
Strikey33 is
there. Strikey33, who's that? Are they here? I give them a pessimist class. And this is the shift that we go through in terms of print. This is also in the Disrupting book, and advise you to come up and get one if you haven't gotten one already, or download it. And I've updated it a little bit. But the idea that virtually everything that we took for granted as being really important for print has now been replaced by some other attribute or some other digital alternative. We used to really spend a lot of time on, well, it's permanent and it's stored, but you can do permanent and stored in the cloud, in cloud computing somewhere. You hope, as long as it's backed up and you have access to it. But you're basically given the equivalent. You used to have to travel to get to the physical one, like travel to a library that you have to ship it to you, but now you can have access to it. So this kind of thing really changes the nature of media, the way we relate to our clients. Media selection is a very important part. Going back to the publishers, publishers used to pick the way they were going to market their products. But when you're active in other kinds of digital media, you can't control those kinds of things. They could work in your favor, they could work against you. Once the buzz starts on the internet, you've got some issues to deal with. So I would recommend that you really take a good hard look at this chart. But the ultimate, but the general aspect of this is that when you're in the marketplace in electronic communications, you're interacting with it on a two-way basis, and sometimes you're not in control of that that interaction because other people are interacting about you. So this gives rise to a new culture for us. Printers, because we tend to be mechanistic and task-focused, have a little difficulty understanding an ROI-based selling practice and also the nature of the way people make decisions about what media they're going to use. CFOs and the CFO mentality has gotten into, partly because of the recession, almost every decision related to media, people demanding to know what they got for their spending. There's an unfortunate downside to that, and that is that branding and corporate image work, which is, I believe, really important and still extremely important to all marketers, takes a beating in that kind of case. Everybody wants to look at direct mail models in terms of instant measurement of things, and they don't necessarily play out in the long term in establishing a brand. So we have to be able to have that kind of discussion with our clients. We move from a more generic product to a lot of specialty products. We start taking responsibility for getting their content into the format that's appropriate for them. We become managers instead of doers because a lot of our workflows become more predictable, more electronic. We become more curious about why people are printing. That's a cultural thing that we've lost. Once we started to lose the pre-press shops and all that and our interactions with the ad agencies, we lost a lot of the understanding of the reasons why people print. That used to help us a lot in making their content work in whatever format that they wanted. Now we're getting jobs when they're considered to be done, and we're just being asked to bid on them. But the larger cultural shift is a sales and marketing and ownership perspective, where we used to go out and get business because it was new there, because people had to print. Now we have to go out and create business. And that business that we create is going to have more and more other media. We'll have to interact with more and more other media. If you saw me at Xerox the past 2 days, at the end of the presentation, we had a QR code that must have been about 6 or 7 feet tall or something like that. And people from where you folks are sitting in the first and second row were putting up their iPhones and it was working. Isn't that absolutely stunning? So just think of posters that are done in that way, that have QR codes or whatever. You've now made print interactive. And a lot, I'm still amazed. Somebody was at the meeting and said, gosh, I've never seen that before. And they were a printer who had been in the business for quite a long time. They weren't even offering QR codes to their customers yet. This is the first time they had ever seen it. So we get to a point where we want to make this transition. We have a marketplace that might be a little unfavorable to us overall. And I'm saying that now's the time to start playing hardball. After all, we only have 3,375 days to get to 2020. And the first thing I would tell you is to focus on your old business. And that's going to sound very strange, but you should focus on your old business and get that thing to be as productive as possible. It may involve new capital investment. It may involve shutting down three presses and getting one. Revolutionizing your workflow in a way that's more accommodative. But the point is, get the old business to the point where it's throwing off money that you can use to invest in the new businesses that are coming. This is not a change in media where you say, if I don't get on the bus right now, I'm going to miss it. The rate of change is so incredible that everybody is lost for a little while, and you can get on that bus almost at any time with hiring the right people and with the right resources. But get the core thing that drives your business running extremely well right now, and that may involve some kind of new investment. So when I say give fixed costs an expiration date, the idea that certain presses were going to be around in the business for 15 or 20 years doesn't really help your business, because you're staying busy but producing unprofitable things very, very often. And that has to change. Anything that is not performing, you should be outsourcing to somewhere else, or working with another organization that you might merge with or do a tuck-in with or whatever to go in and fix that. So figure out what's not working well, and that may be a reason why a particular merger or acquisition candidate is attractive, because they have something that you're missing down pat. You have to prepare for that big date when you're going to do the merger and acquisition. I know it sometimes seems a little cynical, but there are a lot of printing companies who've hired consultants to kind of dress them up and make them look better once they start engaging in a discussion with the potential acquirer. But that's a process that needs to be done just from a financial perspective. And I'm suggesting also that you avoid what I call a defensive merger and acquisition, that we can't stay in business unless we merge with somebody. You've got big problems at that point, because you're going to probably choose the wrong partner. So you want to look for some kind of merger where somebody's going to have resources that either changes your business, adds new products, or creates something foundational so that you're a stronger company so that you can go out and do something different. So the defensive M&A is kind of a backwards-looking thing, but the better one is that more forward-looking, because you're looking for a partner that you're going to be developing new products and go after new markets with. And then there's this question is, we have this competitor, they're having some problems. Can we put them out of business rather than acquiring them? I know that's hardball. But you have to say, some companies are so weak, they're just trying to be acquired to save themselves. And maybe it's better, you're better off acquiring their customers in some other particular way. Because every kind of acquisition has a transition risk to it. They all have assumptions, and some of those assumptions will not play out to be true. And they also have certain representations about the nature of their business, the nature of the skills of the employees, and like, and these things are going to happen where they're just not going to mesh well. And any time you have transition risk, you're losing time. You're chewing up part of that 3,375 days. And we always have to have in the back of our head that most mergers and acquisitions fail. Because they do. So we should be looking to get new skills in our businesses. And one way of doing that is by working with more and more freelancers and other smaller business who have skills that we need. There was a time in our business, and there still is among many players, where we had trade printing and trade services. And we used these people because we knew that they were reliable. There was a sense of common brethren in there, that we were all in the industry together. And so there was an element of trust to that. When I speak with printers about working with many graphic designers and many new media folks, there's always a concern, if I start working with this person, they're going to go after my client directly. So you want to try to find those kinds of things out early. So you have to take the risk, and take that risk a few times, and that's how everyone will start to prove themselves, because they're going to need somebody to market them. They're going to need somebody who already has established client contacts to get them into those particular companies. And you're also looking for people who can work on integrated campaigns, especially if you don't have the skills to do that. We need a lot of new product development. So there needs to be a lot of experimentation and investment in everything that we do as we diversify our product lines. And there's no one place to go to train people to do those things. Those are all going to be trial and error things that we do in combination with our clients. The point is that there are no rules for social media. There are no rules for location-based media. This is all experimental. You can't go to a book. You can't look up a financial ratio. You just have to go out and try it and see what works. You're writing the rules as you're going along. Everybody's writing the rules as we're going along. We used to send people to trade schools and like to learn about printing. There are no equivalents in new media. The thing that makes me optimistic about this, though, is that there is a discipline to our business. We know jobs have a beginning, middle, and an end. We know that a client has to be satisfied with the job. We know that unless we satisfy them, they don't come back to us. And we know that things have to be done on a regular basis. If you've been in the magazine or catalog basis, you have got a schedule to your life that's quite different than many of these new media folks have. Those are the things that we can bring. That's the kind of assurance that our clients should be getting from us. Yet many printers are very afraid of going in front of clients and talking about all these different media. And the only way to get experience with it is actually start using it in your own business. So these are some of the mindsets that I think we really need. We need to compartmentalize the old business. So I said, get your old business healthy, compartmentalize it. Because when you're out trying to build new things, the temptation is always to go back when there's trouble, to go back to what was familiar to you. And it takes a lot of tenacity to not do that and leave that in the hands of the people you've entrusted the older business to. Spend most of your time, if you're a chief executive of a printing company or a media company, you have to spend most of your time exploring new things, talking with clients, and building investment plans around that. Now, that investment plan, the primary thing that most businesses are short of is not money. It's time. And when you're deploying your time in new things, it looks like you're not being productive until you actually implement something. So always be working on that particular plan. And this breathing room that we have, that's what I'm calling this period, all these 5 months of increased sales that look like they may continue for a little while, crossing our fingers, right? That's breathing room, because we still have to deal with the 30, 60, and the 100 thing. That's coming at us. There's no reason that any of us should be blindsided about the kind of media technologies that are on their way to us. No one should be surprised by them at all. How many of you have iPads? Raise your hand. There's you. How many of you have an iPad in the house by some other family member? Including yourself. Okay? All right, so that's one of the issues. So part of our research and development expense for the printing industry, every printing executive, whether they're the owner, the CEO, the CFO, the production manager, all those folks, they should all be getting these things. Why? Because we have to take our clients' content and put it in that context and that format. We already know, for example, that the book Disrupting the Future will not work on the Kindle, and it won't work on the iPad. Why? Because the way the programming structure is set up, our footnotes, some of which are absolutely hilarious, become endnotes, and we wanted them to be close to the content. And there's no way that right now that you can go to the content, put your finger on the iPad on the footnote, and even get a pop-up that tells you what that footnote was. So I wrote a book that's out of date. I wrote a book about the future that's terribly out of date. Look at me. And these are the kinds of things that printers should be advising their clients about. And how do they do that? Because they've had experience trying to do it. That's the way you find out about these things. In fact, there's a book being written on social media that's coming out. I had a discussion with the author about 2 or 3 weeks ago. He was using footnotes. He changed. Caught him just in time. I think he's going to buy me a soda or something one day. So, here we are. Urgency waits for no one. Urgency happens because you place urgency on it. And I want each of you to use those next 3,375 days very wisely. So I want to thank you very much for coming today, and I hope that everyone downloads the presentation and come upstairs and get a book. Thank you very much.
Jack Tinney with Stratmore Company.
Yes.
I can remember about 20 years ago when I first was contemplating getting into the printing business. I went to a seminar kind of similar to this, and the lecturer held up a little shiny thing that was looked kind of like a rainbow, and he shined the light on it, and it colored.
It was a CD, I bet.
CD.
Yes.
And he said, one of these days in the future, you know, everything that you do will be on this. You know, people sort of scoff and look at it for a while, that's what the future is. But I'm wondering if you have something, or if you can see something on the horizon, you mentioned iPads or, you know, smartphones or whatever, that's going to be equivalent to that type of a leap in our business.
Okay. The CD thing didn't work out because the computers were actually too slow to get lots of the stuff, and so we jumped over to the internet. So very often those things that are selected as being extremely important to an industry end up being leapfrogged by something else. Right now, I think things like iPads and smartphones actually end up being rather dumb devices because the cloud and the connectivity, which are technologies that we really can't see. You can't see fast connectivity. You can experience it, but you can't see a device with it. I believe that's where everything is going to be coming from. The display technology is going to change rather dramatically. Sometime next year, we should have foldable and rollable screens. So the idea that you have a pen in your pocket and you can pull it out and get some measure of viewable information on it. It's not going to look as pretty as watching an HD video on an iPhone or an iPad looks, but it's going to be very functional and extremely convenient. There's one thing that one attribute that underscores everything that happens with digital media, and this is why the discussions about digital media not being environmentally friendly and all that, is that consumers choose convenience over all that other stuff constantly. In the history of all product adoptions, all consumer adoptions, it's always been convenience that ends up ruling it. So that's a key element in the adoption of all of these things. But cloud computing, I don't know really how to explain it, except you're always connected to a server, but you don't think you are. and display technologies are going to be the major improvements and major changes that we experience in the short term. But the idea of being constantly connected is just going to be taken for granted, especially by those 60 million people and those 50 million who are going to be born. I have some news, by the way, in case you were wondering about the non-manufacturing Institute of Supply Management numbers. The new orders for up was up, and see on the manufacturing one, it didn't do as good. It was up to 54.9, so that was good.
On the non-manufacturing.
Right, the non-manufacturing, and the imports were up, but that was a 53, so that's good. That's higher than in fact, both of those numbers are higher than the start of the recession. So the service economy seems to be doing much, much better. So thank you, Debbie.
Thank you, Debbie.
Yeah, okay.
Any other questions? Got one right here.
Bob, Joey, you indicate that big M&A and big mergers typically fail, which has been my observation as well.
Yes.
And it's just fascinating to me that here Quiet Graphics is engulfing, you know, a gigantic elephant.
Yes.
They have never, the only time they've ever bought anything like 15 years ago was a professed frustration at the ability to integrate that entity. It seems that R.R. Donnelly is like a kid in a candy shop in the marketplace because of the distraction of this venerable supplier to the industry. It just seemed like, wow.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised by that as well, because there were quite a few things at play there. First thing, I didn't think the Quadratri family wanted to be public, just in terms of privacy issues and the like. but this deal just may have been too good for them to pass up. That implied to me, I have not asked anybody in that family about this, but it also implied to me that the family may have been getting so large that it's easier to have family members exit a public company than it is to constantly be calling in appraisers and all to figure out what the value of some family member share of stock is. So that may be part of a longer succession strategy or family estate management process. So those were the things that I thought of.
I actually talked to Joel.
Yes.
And what maybe people may not be aware of is the family owns 80% of the company. And so while they're public, and Joel will tell you that he's always run the company as though it were a public company from an accounting perspective, you'll be seeing them do things like not giving much guidance on the ability to do that. And so he doesn't feel that they're going to be under the quarter-to-quarter pressure that a normal business will have. You know, they've got the preferred versus the general stock. A lot of employees own stock. And if anybody's going to make this work, they're one of the best managed companies in our industry, and they're going to be able to do it. And you saw, they moved very quickly.
They certainly did. They certainly did.
One of which was their own, by the way.
Yes. So, but it's easier to make those moves in the beginning. You know, there's a honeymoon period where people can do that.
You know, so, what was also interesting to me, I never knew this before. When Joel Quadracci, the CEO of this now, what, $2 billion company?
Something like that.
When he's in the office, he wears the same uniform that everybody on the floor wears. Every employee wears those uniforms. In the administration office, the HR people, and really brings the company together. And the new company that was acquired, they didn't really have a culture at the top level. They had plant cultures. They are like clamoring to get those uniforms because they want that. They want to be part of that. It's kind of an interesting thing.
But his has a cape.
His has a cape.
Yeah,
right.
So,
it saves on laundry.
It'll be extremely interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of the things that they bought were just not working well, but they seemed to move very aggressively. I think it was $500 million of duplications and efficiencies, with about half coming from each company, in order to according to the original offering documents. So, as opposed to someone like R.R. Donnelly, you get the sense that the financial folks are in charge, as opposed to a printing culture there. So. Somebody from R.R. Donnelly might be very upset with me, but then usually when I say things like that, people get me in the corner and say, I couldn't say that you were right publicly. go ahead. Joel, Mr. Mason, one of my favoritest of all-time consultants and former Gamus members. And
Joe, you mentioned you were writing a book. I'd just be interested in your definition of a book today and what you think a book will be 5 years from now.
Oh, that's a good one. A book is basically a collection of thoughts that's longer than an article. Is that flexible enough for you? Because I love the format of the book. You know, have any of you read Disrupting the Future? Not to make a... But if you've read the footnotes, even in the PDF, the footnotes work. But I can't write like that anyway. I like writing like that because, first of all, I have a little bit of academic training. Secondly, it reminds me of the time that I was doing a study for a particular organization that I know you and I were in at one time, where they accused me of not doing the research because there were footnotes in it. Who is that? So it is a collection of thoughts, and the question is, how do you present it? In the book, we're able to work with the format and get away with it. But to create a collection of actual data in a format that works in multiple formats takes a lot of planning up front. As far as me giving away the book in PDF, I mean, I'm always going to have that. That will always be part of what I do. And I'll always have a hard copy. The question is, what do we do in the e-books? And that's still a question to me, because PDFs on iPads don't work very well. That may change, but there's still a lot of experimentation that needs to go on, but I would just define it by the length of the. That's the way I would define a book. It's a collection of thoughts, perhaps 20,000-30,000 words.
Today, books are. I mean, your book is a great example of really a hybrid model, because you've got a resource page on the web where or you can keep it up to date. And because you're printing it on demand, you can actually change the content anytime you want.
Exactly.
So it's a hybrid model. It's not, you know.
Yeah, it's a base of content, and we have to deploy it, but. That may be one of the problems that a lot of the small publishers end up running into, which is good for us because we can become experts in that. They have the core content, they know the core format that they like to work toward, but then getting it in all these other formats poses challenges that they're not going to be able to understand from a process point of view. They'll understand it from a conceptual point of view.
Okay, before my question, I'll just point out before you get too excited about those uniforms that not everybody that wears them loves the style.
Okay.
In particular, I've run into some of the ladies from their group that are at trade shows, and they have some comments about the design of them. Now, as to my question.
Yes.
Being involved with mailing, I'm curious about your point of view about the post office in the year 2020, and less about the economics, more about the and how that might impact mailing over time. I think those of us that are in that part of the business a lot would say that we have concerns in particular about relevancy. Many of us grew up in a time when the items we received in the mail we could expect to be really important, and as it becomes only advertising, it becomes less relevant, especially as the younger demographic starts to grow up and spend money. So how do you feel about that part?
Right, we're coming to the time where anything that's very important will be delivered by a process server, right? It's this chart, and this is something that the Postal Service has no way of coping with. And this is something that they've been ignoring for decades. You know, if you look at the story of UPS, once UPS realized that their competitor was FedEx and not the USPS, they changed their business radically. But the USPS never realized that their competition was going to be coming from other forms of media. And the erosion rate was usually so small that a lot of their planning, and even for printing organizations, could not detect any kind of erosion for it. Because if mail volume would be growing at 2.5%, but the economy would be growing at 3%, they say, oh, that's close. But now the difference is so incredibly stark that that it's obvious what the issues are. I have a hero called Lysander Spooner, who was a libertarian lawyer in the 1800s, who started his own postal company and was put out of business by Congress, which is the same law that prevents other businesses from getting into delivery of postal services. And he was delivering a mail cheaper than the Postal Service at that time, and his business kept going up, because he had much better service than they did, and it was like by a factor of 10 at that time. The Postal Service is not free. They have no idea what prices to charge. They have no idea what products to offer, because all their prices and all their products are in the law. So there's very little innovation that they can do except little things around the edges. And most of the innovations that they have are to shift costs onto the people who are mailing. Right, so if you take more and more of their work and do the pre-sorts and the organizations and meet the specs of their equipment, you get discounts. Right, that's not a new product offering. And that goes to the heart of the problem. Because it has no competition, it has to exist. So until organizations have the threat of death, then they're not going to be as responsive as they should.
Do you think the latest decision of the Postal Regulatory Commission is a threat of death? For the
post office? No, not at all. But that is the problem, and we're going to be having that just we will have that exact question in 2020. Except you'll be asking about 2030.
Any other? Okay, she's going to make more.
Yes, you didn't do the treadmill. Oh, don't cut in! Don't cut. That's cheating. I missed the last time we sparred back at what a Prism luncheon in 1993 we're talking about?
Way back when.
Hair. Yes, I did. I certainly did.
And we both had dark hair.
Yes.
In terms of certain segments, like packaging, point of purchase, which is still relatively healthy, because consumer packaged goods companies are still doing a lot of point of purchase. purchase. Do you see that turning electronic eventually and that industry getting hit as well?
I don't necessarily see that industry getting hit. I see it getting more interesting. You talk about e-paper and other kinds of inexpensive computer screens on point of purchase, point of sale, they have to be attached to something generally. But you're going to see a lot of hybrid point of sale, point of purchase things that include computer screens delivering content at the same time that they are serving as a way means of displaying product. So that will be an extremely interesting area. Remember, the packaging industry has a couple of things going for it. Population keeps growing, keeps getting older, and the pharmaceutical industry keeps inventing things for us to take. And the health and beauty aids industry keeps inventing things for us to apply. And their bottles change, and the formats change, and the regulations change, and pretty soon I think the nutrition facts is going to be bigger than the actual product itself. So it's a very interesting market. It's going to be around for a long time. It's not easily displaced because it has to protect and display the product. Now, if everything starts getting shipped by UPS, the packaging constraints in terms of graphics change quite considerably because it's not on display on a shelf. It can be a little less attractive graphically. But that's a market that has a floor to it at least. And the changes within it offer great opportunities in terms of new materials and new shapes and sizes and all. So that will be around for quite a while. And I would suggest to you that we start calling those kinds of things the offline media industry. And it's somewhere here on this chart. And merging the electronics there. We think merging QR codes with print makes it electronic. Putting e-paper on point-of-purchase displays that are printed offer a whole range of new applications. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Are QR codes a fleeting technology, and what would be replacing it? And then is there a vendor here that is a QR technology vendor?
There are loads of devices on the floor that could create QR codes. But if you're doing it occasionally, you just go on the web and put in QR code free, and you'll be able to change a web address or an email address to a QR code for free. And you download a JPEG or whatever. This brings up the whole issue of electronic printing and implanting chips or printing chips or printing electronics on printed goods. That still has a ways to go in figuring out how that's going to happen. We know physically how it's going to happen, but how will users find it and how will users start using it is up in the air. But many of those QR codes will get to a point where you just put it near your computer. You don't even have to take a picture of it, and you'll be able to do something with it because it'll have some kind of electronics or some kind of detectable aspect to it that's already in our ink or another thing that we apply to things as we print them. So is it passing? All things technological are passing. Is that particular format going to be replaced by others? There are already competitive formats for that will work. But that's the popular format right now.
And maybe more fleeting is a personalized URL.
Yes. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yes, we have.
We do.
He says it's clear.
Okay.
Excuse me, you provide a lot of interesting metrics from time to time on paper industry, printing industry, publishing industry. Just curious if you're tracking or about to share with us any social media metric that we can refer to.
There's some interesting metrics that are, I don't find them all in one place. I just find them scouring the internet. And they sometimes show up all together in some of the presentations that Mary Meeker at Morgan Stanley produces. And I try to link to her presentation. She makes a big presentation about twice a year. This last one listed various Facebook sites in terms of their the friended a company or whatever. And she compared their number of people following that site to TV audiences. So there's an online game company that makes a Texas Hold'em poker that has more followers than viewers of NCIS. So you're going to see a lot more of that, comparing a Facebook audience to a broadcast audience, and with the idea that, wait a second, that broadcast audience may not care about my product at all, but this Facebook audience had to actually go sign up for it. So there's a motivational thing in there that's very attractive to advertisers. Over these next 10 years, you're going to have a real problem figuring out what's happened to advertising, because advertising is going to look like it's declining, because I think we're looking at the death of a lot of advertising forms. And things like social media don't have a space purchase cost. They have a creation and a deployment cost, but you don't have to purchase space for them. And they have an ongoing cost of communicating with that audience, but it's not like you have to buy ad pages or buy TV time to do it. So we're going to see advertising look like a very flat industry. But inside the agency, there's all kinds of stuff shifting around. This past 5 years and this next decade will be the continual raising of the visibility of public relations and all things that look like public relations, of which social media and search engine optimization and other things are. And let me put it this way. The ad people used to know the right places to go for lunch, and you used to go to the White Castle with the PR folks. It's going to go the other way around.
Are there any additional questions? Okay, what I'd like to do is turn the microphone over to What They Think's founder and CEO, Randy Davidson. He hates it when
I wanted to thank everybody again for coming. I wanted to make sure, I know this is, you guys probably know this, but one of the most popular areas on whatthethink.com is the area we created for this gentleman. It's the Economics and Research Center, which Joe runs. But every week, every Monday, about 35 to 40 Mondays a year, he writes a column where he analyzes all of the data. Most of you all know about that. He also has a free blog, though, where if something comes up, he posts his comments and opinions there. And then there's also a newsletter that about 7,000 people get that goes out every week. And it's a synopsis it's got troves of free information in it, but it's a synopsis of the week's content. So in case you didn't get a chance, or if you were traveling or whatever, you can get the newsletter and see the blog post headlines and audio charts and things that he does. So he's pretty active in that area, and if you just go to What They Think, click on the Economics and Research Center, it's got a lot of great information, especially if you're doing year-end planning and need some charts to plug in. And is the chart of the week, is it still the chart of the week?
It's just called the chart for this week.
He keeps trying to negotiate with me. He wants it to be the chart of the month, the chart of every 6 months.
And we also have invented a new verb at What They Think. We when we have something new, especially from Dr. Joe, we face tweet link it. So it goes out simultaneously to Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. So check your face tweet link accounts for the most up to date information.
I have one favor to ask everyone. When you're on the show floor and somebody says, "Was Dr. Joe depressing today?" Tell them about this chart, okay? Tell them print sales are looking good the past few months.
Tell them Dr. Doom is a thing of the past. Okay, thank everybody for coming. And
I haven't thanked Man Roland officially yet, but thank Man Roland very much. This is the eighth time that they've done this. And they have no control over what I say. And boy, do they regret that sometimes. No. But I really appreciate that very, very much. I've never had an arm twisted or anything like that to say one particular thing or another. So they definitely earned their respect for doing that.
And you're going to be in the Man Roland booth?
I'll be at the Man Roland booth, 8:58, and I will be there in 15 minutes.
So get your signed, autographed copy of Disrupting the Future. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.